Thank you for joining us today on Geezers of Gear, episode number 194. Today's podcast is brought to you by Stratum Productions. Bringing clarity and order to the chaotic event industry, Stratum is your single source pro AVL rental and design resource, proudly servicing shows and special events throughout North America. Founded in the heartland, the company's Midwestern values, relentless pursuit of perfection, and relationship-driven customer focus helps separate them from the rest. From the first downbeat to the final curtain call, the Stratum Pro team of industry titans are committed to providing the best gear and technical support available to help you create immersive events that will leave crews thankful and crowds speechless. To learn more about this great company, please visit stratumpro.com. Also, please visit www.coffeecult.com. That is coffee with K and cult with K, coffeecult.com, and search for Geezer's Grind. It's a killer blend that's not too strong, but will definitely get you going every morning. And proceeds from the sales of this coffee go to Roby Backstage to support people in this industry with medical or other life challenges. So please visit coffeecult.com and buy Geezer's Grind today. Well, hello there, and again, thank you for joining me today on Geezers of Gear, episode number 194. And so this week, I believe NAMM opens today. I'm recording this on April 13th, 2023, and NAMM starts today, National Association of Music Merchants. And as a side story, I actually grew up going to that show. I know people who know me know that I grew up in the music retail business, selling guitars and amplifiers and that kind of stuff. And prior to that, of course, I was a professional musician. But I think I went to my first NAMM show around maybe 1986, 85, probably 84 even. A long, long time ago, and it was a different show back then. I mean, it was cool. You'd be walking down the aisles and bump into Eddie Van Halen or all kinds of just crazy, talented, amazing people. And at the time, it was very hard for end users to get into the show. It was very sort of exclusive to music retailers and manufacturers, and then, you know, invited rock stars and stuff. So it was always a really, really cool show where you saw lots and lots of famous guitar heroes and stuff. And the parties were legendary. I mean, you know, Kramer Guitars used to have an unbelievable party where, again, Eddie Van Halen and all the sort of big cheese guitar slingers from back then would play at these parties, and very, very cool events to go to. The show was amazing. And I actually believe that I went to one of the very first NAMM shows as well, where they started to have a lighting section. And if I remember correctly, early it was just kind of, they were scattered about. And then what they did is NAMM decided, hey, we're going to organize this and go after more lighting manufacturers and stuff. So they created a lighting section. And the first year, as I recall, they had it downstairs. So you had to go to the basement of NAMM to try and find lighting companies. And it was pretty empty down there for the most part and pretty lonely. And so that was in, I'm guessing, maybe 93, 94. It was early to mid-90s. And since that time, NAMM has really grown to become a pretty important show. And now the Parnelli Awards are during the NAMM show. And, you know, they're really converging the musical instrument world with the pro gear world. And it's pretty easy for lighting to get lost in that, you know, especially pro lighting, because, you know, the big $10,000, $12,000 light fixtures don't sell in music stores. And, So I don't know that NAMM is the greatest show for that kind of stuff. NAMM is a big organization and lots of people. But, you know, if one out of every 5,000 people is actually interested in lighting, you know, it's a lot of expense because you're paying the same amount of money that Roland and Fender guitars and Gibson guitars are paying per square foot, basically. But they obviously are getting 4,999 out of those 5,000 people, and you're getting one. And so I don't know that the value is great for manufacturers. I guess we'll wait and see. I know probably companies like ADJ, maybe even Chauvet, Megalite, those types of companies that have sort of the lower end music store types of products, they would do really well at this show. As far as the top pro brands, I don't know. I'd have to talk to them and see what they think. But if you're going, have fun. I wish I was going, but I just have to be in the office this week. I was gone last week to England, and so, yeah, I'm stuck here. Speaking of shows, ProLight is this month, April 25th to 28th in Frankfurt. Who's going? So GearSource, I believe, will have a presence there. Sarah, who is our biz dev rep in Europe, I believe Sarah will be going to the show, so you can connect with Sarah through Sarah@gearsource.com, I would expect, and set up an appointment or whatever, sit and talk with her, have a beer, whatever it is. Sarah's a great lady. She's a very big part of our team, and she's very thorough, so I'm sure she'd be happy to sit with you. It's a great show. I mean, if you've been to ProLight, it's sort of like NAMM times five or six. You know, they've got all of these massive halls, and you got to take buses between the halls, and it's just... it's an easy show to get lost in. It's a massive, massive show, and you spend half your day on buses or walking between these halls and stuff. But it's a cool show. It's a very exciting show, a lot of fun, a lot of fun after hours too. And I've been several times. I just haven't managed to find a really good reason to go back to Europe here in a couple of weeks. So I likely will not be going this year. Maybe go back next year. Gear, one of our favorite topics, is finding its way back to some weird version of normal. And so on GearSource, my company, we are seeing normal listings again. Lots and lots more listings. Lots of the good stuff that for the last 2 years was non-existent, we're starting to see more of it. Big sound systems, big line array systems that, you know, like K2 systems and stuff that people are really looking for. Lots more of the LA amp racks and stuff coming about, which is good because those things just were gold over the last 18 months. You couldn't get them either from the manufacturer or from us. And now we're starting to see them available. So that's good. You know, I think on some things, the prices are still up pretty high, but sort of stable at this point. You know, it's not like prices are still climbing and gear is wildly unavailable and stuff like that. It's gotten back to a point where if you want something, you can pretty much get it fairly quickly. And yeah, so I mean, we're seeing sort of a robust uptick in business. Things are going well, and it's an exciting time. So, and what else did I want to talk to you about? Speaking of sound, so my last podcast, I believe it was probably 193, was with a company out of Calgary, Canada, my hometown, called PK Sound. Really cool company. If you haven't heard of these guys or you didn't hear the podcast, maybe go back and listen to episode 193. With Jeremy, who's the founder of PK Sound. And so the really cool thing that PK Sound has is it's a line array and you hang it straight and then you basically analyze the room and then the system moves itself into a curved array and angles itself based on what the settings need to be for that room. So you don't have to drop it again and adjust the bars and all that stuff. It's all completely automated and motorized. Really, really cool. And, you know, great sounding stuff. They use the same drivers as D&B, all powered boxes. Really, really, really nice stuff. So check out PK Sound. I think it's something that you would probably find pretty interesting. And so today, I'm really excited, actually, about the guest we have today. I'm so happy that he was able to find the time to do this. A designer I've been following for a while. I love his work. I love the size of some of his work, all of his work, actually. He's one of these guys that gets to do these monster, monster things. And this gentleman can be found today working with some of the most successful artists and shows in the world of music, including Adele, Phil Collins, Rammstein, and the Rolling Stones. And so please welcome Mr. Roland Grill. Roland, hello, how are you?
Very good indeed, very good, and a pleasure to be here with you today.
Is it morning, afternoon, or evening where you are?
It's evening, actually. We just had our family dinner, which is one of the great things of being at home, because you do your office work during the day, and then you have a lovely family dinner, and then you look after your US business, which is perfectly slots in after the little one goes to bed. So at home in Munich at the moment, which is cool.
Perfect. Perfect. So you're in the city. I remember reading or hearing somewhere that you live in the mountains or near the mountains or.
Basically, I grew up very much on the countryside in between Munich and the mountains. So yeah. I've always been a mountain boy.
Yeah.
In our day and age, I live a little bit outside of Munich in a small town, but literally, I think 5 miles to the city limits of Munich, which gives me the best of both worlds.
Yeah.
So you have all the amenities of a decently big city, but when I open up my door to my house, it's all green fields and woods and nice trails to walk, and a good combination.
That's good. Yeah, I'm a mountain guy too, so I was born and raised and grew up in Calgary, Canada, and right. So I have a house just outside of Calgary in the mountains, and love it. You know, I go there for the summer, and I'm leaving in another few weeks to go until October. And I just love it up there. I just get a different feeling. Like some people love to look out at the ocean. I like that too, but I just, something about mountains that do it for me.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I even whatever, that's 13 years or 12 years ago, I took a little break from our crazy industry to recharge the batteries. And I went to Alaska to stay for 3.5 months over the winter in Alaska to go snow machining and heli skiing, and threw all my dollars into heli blades and had a hell of a time. So the mountains do it for me, and it was that I was recharged and full steam ahead.
Alaska, heli skiing in Alaska. Geez, there you go.
Yeah.
Like there's a lot of heli skiing around where I have my house, and I've done it not recently because the older I get, the harder it is to prepare my legs just for regular skiing now, you know, because I can't ski. I can still, from a talent standpoint, I can still ski at the level that I did when I was 20 years old. But from a fitness standpoint, you know, my legs are just so tired so quickly. So I don't trust myself to go heli skiing anymore. It's just, I think I would have an epic crash.
All right, fair enough.
and epic crashes have less appeal the older I get, you know.
Absolutely. I get you.
Yeah. So you've been very busy. I appreciate you taking the time to you know, to schedule this in the middle of all the little things that you're working on these days. So so you know, I want to if you've ever heard any of my podcasts, I like to kind of talk through a little bit about your story, how you got into it. You know, you've probably told it before, so I apologize, but my audience probably hasn't heard it. I heard a rumor that you actually either wanted to or started out as an audio guy.
I wanted to be an audio guy. I mean, that's a long, long time ago. I had this come to Jesus moment when I was about, I think, 7 or 8 years old. My good old dad took me to a country and western concert in the area where I grew up. Literally,
had German country and western.
Yeah, it's not at all comparable to what it is in the States, obviously.
But yeah.
There are those more or less cover bands, and it's all a very small amateur level scene. But there's a scene.
But and, is it American country music or is it German similar?
There are takes on German takes on American country music. Most of them are horrible, to be honest, and very cheesy.
I can imagine.
There's definitely some country out there, even old country, which I really love and I've got a lot of respect for.
Yeah.
But I would say 80% of the country and Western bands or country bands and in Germany, they are cover bands. They're playing everything from Johnny Cash to Garth Brooks and possibly nowadays also some music of the younger guys out there, not being into one in whatever 25 years now.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, that specific country and Western concert, I don't remember the band's name or anything. Little Roland saw this sound engineer behind his mixing board, actually. And that was, as I said, the come to Jesus moment where I said, it's like, I want to be a sound engineer. This is my plan for my future. I abandoned all the plans of getting a firefighter or a race car driver or astronaut or whatever.
Yeah.
And I wanted to be a sound engineer. And so that was the mission from that point onwards. And then fast forward, whatever, 2-3 years, I started to solder and build my own little homemade lighting systems for my room, my kids' room at my parents' house. And then I started to rent that out to friends who celebrated any parties or did any parties. Started to work as a local stagehand in Munich, never got paid for it, but nevertheless, I felt like the king of the world working at a Tina Turner show.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, I just put up 10,000 folding chairs. It was my job, but nevertheless, I was working there.
I did similar things. I did, I was very, very small, skinny kid when I was like 14, 15 or whatever, and I got hired by a promoter in Calgary, Canada, to work security at concerts. And I'm thinking, me, security, little long-haired skinny kid, I couldn't have stopped anybody or anything from happening. I don't know how I got hired as security, but usually I ended up putting away chairs.
Yeah, fair enough. Then obviously that put me in touch or got me in touch with some smaller local lighting and sound companies. And I started to work for them doing local gigs. And around about the age of 17, 18, a little bit before I graduated school or finished school, I thought sound is fun, but sound is not necessarily creative enough for me. It's like literally because sound, at least in a live sound environment, you need expertise and there's absolutely knowledge needed to do it without any doubts. But it's a very academic process because your mission is to transport whatever is happening on stage, if there's a band playing or a musical or whatever, in the best possible way to the audience and make it
it
hearable.
I never thought of it like that. Like, you're exactly right. Like, sound is basically, it's either good sound or bad sound. There's not creative ways of manipulating the sound or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's good sound or bad sound. If you're a good sound guy or girl, you're going to make it sound really good. But there's not a lot of creativity to that. I agree with you. That's a very, very good point. I've never thought of it that way.
Yeah. I mean, it's different if you think about the studio engineers. There's creativity if they create new music and how you mix it and how you whatever.
Yeah, they get more into producing and stuff, right?
Yeah. Exactly. But in a live environment, at least for me, it was not creative enough. So I moved on to lighting and then really pretty much worked my way up through the food chain. It's like literally from working on small gigs around here, rigging lights and pulling cables and pushing boxes, to rigging lights and pushing boxes on tours in Germany, then in an international scale, and moved on from there into more the programming side of things and more technical nitty-gritty stuff.
Yeah, I'm not going to ask you your age, but when you got started doing all that stuff, was that pre-moving lights or were there already moving lights?
It was kind of the time where, like, literally moving lights were around, mostly very light. As a moving light, as a moving hat, it was only very light when I started, basically. And there were scanners, but it was still predominantly times with generics, with Parkans, Moles, Lecos, all that stuff.
Yeah.
So very old school. And when I really got kind of involved in the industry, it was still amazing to have whatever 8 scanners on your tour or on your show. And it was because, again, when I started, I was not doing Rolling Stones or Phil Collins or Genesis or whatever big shows, which obviously back at that day already played with bigger automated rigs. But
yeah,
it was far off the scale. That was like a different planet. I'm thankful that I started to learn to work with generics and with conventional lighting, because that gives you, I think, a good background and a lot of rules and approaches which you take with conventionals and generics, you can easily translate into the world of
I agree.
Automated lighting
yep.
and make a difference.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. And I would have to say, you know, without shaming any younger people or anything, that I generally appreciate shows done by people who had done it before without moving lights. I generally like those shows more because they use moving lights more. I don't know. It's just different. It's more nuance and less just in your face kind of, you know, moving them just because they can move kind of thing. Right. It just seems more planned and more, I don't know, creative, more theatrical, whatever you want to call it.
100%, 100%. And it's like, I've done for the last, whatever, 15 years, I've done quite a few lectures around the world. And what I love to say is like, literally, it's not a moving light because it has to move, for instance.
Right.
It's an automated light, which can, you can use it in multiple focuses and in multiple colors and everything. But sometimes having whatever, a big value or a great effect could be awesome. But it doesn't need to move all the way for your show.
You know, it's funny.
It takes
when I've had really, really early Verilight people on the podcast, and we talked about that. Mm-hmm. And you know, originally they were moving black, and mm-hmm. You know, when they were doing the stuff for Genesis in the very early days, and you know, somebody saw one that there was a mistake or a failure or something, and it moved with the light still on without the shutter closed. And it was like, whoa, 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 wait, what did I just see? You know, and once once that cat got out of the bag, you know, then it was like, okay, these things need to move with the light on. And yep. But that's not how it was intended. It was just supposed to reposition. It wasn't supposed to be a moving beam. So it's kind of a funny thing. So what was like your first big show or your first tour or like the first thing when you went, wow, this is it. Like, this is really what I want to do forever.
As a tour, possibly Floyd. Floyd, when they took Pulse in the 94, 95, something like that, which I saw as a younger kid.
Yeah.
Again, with my dad back in the day, because that obviously what Brickman did for them was pretty
was
outstanding, especially for that time.
Yeah.
And obviously I was already kind of drawn into any kind of technology, which was related to shows or to the event world or show world, but entertainment world.
What about the first one that you actually did that you worked on?
Oh,
first memorable thing, the first like bigger memorable show or tour.
Possibly it was working for a German artist, and that was a Lampy, actually, kind of Peter Maffay, big chest in Germany, Austria, Switzerland. So nobody will know him abroad. But nevertheless, he fills arenas, and back in the day, he even filled stadiums over here.
Hmm. And he was a German artist.
The German artist, And then I was out on the road as a simple Lampy rigging lights, and the show was done by my dear friend Günther Jeckle, old German LD again. Yeah. Somebody who's been big in the German market, never really made it out of the German market or didn't want to. And he did a fabulous job, because he picked on, especially what we just said, a very theatrical approach. Like, literally, lights don't need to move. It's all about great looks, and the combination just, there was some magic in it, because the lighting he's created, and it was a simple but still good looking set design, combined with the music, which was performed in a very cool way, was just one of those magical moments, which again kind of convinced me 100% that I've done the right decision to not go to university and take or do a study and get a doctor or something like that. And at the end of the day, it's like literally convinced me on my way, and it showed me where I went ahead. I mean, it was always this step-by-step process, because when you're working on those tours, then you're obviously looking at, I want to get back behind the board at some point, and you want to program it. And then you do that, and then you start to look out in the world and see that, obviously, in terms of the live entertainment market, beside of Rammstein, Germany is very much or Germany, Switzerland, Austria is very much an enclave or a very small market, because we've got bigger acts over here and they fill stadiums and they fill arenas, no problem. But they do it within the three German-speaking countries, which is Germany, Switzerland, and Austria.
Yeah.
So we are not necessarily the hotspot for the international touring scene or international live entertainment scene.
Yeah.
So you obviously, I got kind of very much attracted to work in either in the UK or in the US to get leave that bubble of Germany and to work for some bigger names and do some proper touring where you're out on the road for a year or travel around the world.
Yeah,
and it was all those steps, and then I moved on. And I mean, I've always been a little kind of, I had the luck at the right moments of time to meet the right people who gave me chances and who took me under their wings and gave me chances to break out of our national market into the more international market.
Yeah, I'm guessing it was more than just luck. You know, I've read a lot of things about you and heard some interviews and stuff, and people tend to really be sort of attached to just your general attitude and how nice of a person you are, how easy you are to work with and how good you are to work with. And I think that, you know, and I'm going to sound really old, but young kids these days really need to learn that. Like, they need to learn, first of all, that you should say yes a lot. You know, you should always try and figure out a way to do it. If somebody asks you, do you know how to do this? You should say, oh yeah, yep, I can do that. And then go figure it out really quickly, right?
Yep.
Within safety, you know, boundaries, of course. But the other one is, you know, pardon my French, but don't be an asshole, basically. You know, be a nice person and a 100%. Person that people want to work with and share a bus with, God forbid, or whatever, right? And you seem to be one of those guys, and I think that obviously helps.
Absolutely. I tried my best, and I mean, thanks God, again, I had the honor to learn from quite a few really good people, but learn, obviously, the craft of either programming or designing or working as a lampy back in the day, it doesn't matter. But I were, foremost, I also learned how to act and behave within our industry, and how to, I think, the higher you go up in the ranks, if you can say it that way, but day by day, it gets more important to be a humble, nice human being. And it's more about the political thing than also accept at some point that ultimately, we are all service providers. We are, if you're now in the role of designing big shows, yes, you are a creative. Yes, you are a designer, but you're not an artist.
You're not the star.
Exactly. It's never about us, or nearly never about us, except you're doing whatever, one of those lighting festivals where you light the Red Square in Moscow or something like that. There you possibly
the light
in
is the
middle
art.
Of Exactly.
No, it's funny. There's a few designers I could mention who do think that they're the artist, you know, and I won't mention who they are, but everyone knows some of them for sure. But I mean, you're exactly right. You know, just being humble and being a nice enough person. But the other thing that I've read about you was, you know, your management of budgets too. Like, you know, sometimes I know designers who say, well, absolutely not. If I can't get those 100 fixtures, I cannot make this show work, you know? And you seem to be the guy who says, okay, well, you know, if we're losing X amount of dollars from the budget, you know, let me figure out what I can do. And you just make it work, right?
100%. And I mean, in my opinion, or from my point of view, the word design is by definition an art form that technically needs to work, and that obviously means that it needs to technically work within the kind of the restraints you have in terms of arena size, venue size, something like that. But it also obviously indicates or includes that it needs to work within the given budget. And
it's very important.
I think 100%, because it doesn't matter if you're doing a small theater project or if you're doing some of the biggest touring shows out there, Rammstein or something like that, or Genesis, which I had the honor to do. But even there, there is a budget limit, especially nowadays, especially the music industry has changed. As most of the artists, or nearly all the artists nowadays, make their money by doing live shows,
Right.
and any kind of album or so is more to promote new live shows.
Yeah.
It's the opposite way around
Yeah, everything
as it has
flipped.
been.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, it used to be
exactly
where you
so.
toured to sell records. Now you tour to make money, and selling records is just sort of an art form. It's not really a profit center. So
absolutely. So
unless you're Taylor Swift, I guess. Taylor Swift makes money on everything she touches. But
it's true.
But yeah.
But that's the exceptions to the rule.
Yeah, for sure. So how
but ultimately it comes down to money. So you've got to deliver within your restraint.
Of course. Yeah, no. And again, I mean, don't be an asshole. Be a nice person that people want to tour with and want to be around. And, I read, I don't know if it was on your website or something, but I read lots of, just testimonials and comments from people just saying, he's just a great person. And, that matters. I mean, because in our industry, there are some who are not, unfortunately. So,
yep.
So I'm fast forwarding a little bit, I think, but, first I want to ask you, you went from being what you're calling a lampy to being, a programmer, I guess. What was the first console that you programmed?
The very first console, very lucky you won't know it is, from JB, or it was, on the generic side, it was, I think, in, Everlights and Sapphire or so. 120 channel console, which just got DMX on board. So in my very early days, we still used analog consoles. Nevertheless, DMX was around already. So it was not before that time. In terms of intelligent or automated lighting, it wasn't JB lighting, something which was a very small controller.
Yeah, I remember those. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or the Scan Commander.
Then Scan
Eventually.
Commander, obviously.
Yeah.
Exactly. Moving on to MA, then Scan Commander, and then as the whole industry progressed, we all progressed to Holoc 2 spec, basically.
Yeah.
Got a very short stint on a Hawk 1, but that was not really, and that was also the time when this thing was out. I wasn't really in the programming chair.
Yeah.
But Hawk 2 was the one where my programming career really started.
Yeah.
Started with.
Yeah, Hog 2, I've talked about this with other people before, but Hog 2, I think, changed the industry in that programmers were suddenly being paid as programmers, and it became like a real art form and a real, a job where you could actually make a better day rate than just being a lighting tech or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
Hog
2 seemed to really change that. And I remember people, it became a marketplace where it was like, hey, do you know any Hog programmers? Do you know any Hog programmers? And, I was always connecting programmers with shows who needed programmers and stuff. So, Hog 2 seemed to change that. So, I mean, in Germany, do you even have a choice of console anymore? Or is it just an MA console and that's it?
In our days, I think the market is pretty much dictated by MA. I mean, there are still a few others out there. There are a few Gemsys consoles out there. They're very likely a few Flying Pig consoles out there.
Yeah.
But pretty much, at least at a certain scale of show, is the same as anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
The weapon of choice is an MA.
So are you MA2 Which or MA3?
I mean, as I don't program that many shows by myself anymore, to be honest, the only show in the last, 5-6 years I've programmed by myself was the video gig on Stones and still programmed by myself.
Yeah.
I stayed with MA2 to a certain degree because it did everything for me. And
A known entity.
Too fun, exactly. And it's I think the MA3 platform will be great and is already great and will be absolutely the next step. But as with a lot of things, you need time to
you have to stop your life and learn it.
Exactly, dive into it and make it work, and then you've got to use it. I mean, you've got to have to be in the saddle and use it to really get efficient on it.
Yeah. People have such opinions on that. I love to ask the question because, I know some people who are very qualified, very fast programmers on the MA2, and it's muscle memory. You know, every movement that you need to make, it's all muscle memory. You've done it so many times. And MA3, you have to stop everything and think about it. And you got to do things. And it's a different syntax and all of this stuff. And so it's not that it's better or worse. It's just, you know, an annoyance, right? Because they're just used to it, right? So,
And I mean, the big difference, if you compare it when it all changed from MA1 to MA2, and that was still my heavy programming days, basically, somewhat 10 years ago, we hit every limit you can with MA1 consoles. So they were just on their limit in terms of performance and what they could do and what you could achieve with them. And you've built systems which were really not stable anymore because they were just out of their comfort zone. And there was a need to move on to MA2 because the MA2 platform had more performance. It was a better tool to program this size of rigs we were then back in the day controlling. That is slightly different. I think for 95% of all shows around the world, doesn't matter in which part of the industry, you can, without any problem, you can run it on a two.
Yeah.
So it will take a little more time. And as you say, the muscle memory is the one thing, but it's also about finding the time and also the motivation to learn something new if you don't need to learn something new.
It's true.
They will do it because it will be better. It progresses and all their ideas are good. So
it's also the MA2 consoles are going to be dying, you know, because they can't, they can only support them so long. And so people are already running MA3s with MA2 software, a lot of them, obviously. And eventually, I think it's just going to make so much sense. And a lot of the designers I talk to now have already switched over and they're on MA3 now. You know, they just took some downtime, figured out the console, got comfortable with it, and went out and toured with it. You know, it was also a really bad timing thing, I think, for MA Lighting because of COVID. You know, right when they came out with the console, everyone stopped touring, so nobody was using it, and so it was a very problematic time for that to happen. Not that I feel sorry for them, because now they're selling as many consoles as they can produce, but So when did you, obviously it was a very good luck thing or a very positive thing that you connected with Patrick and Adam. And so how and when did that take place?
That's an interesting question because I can't tell you exactly how it happened. First of all, I connected with Adam. That's somewhat by now, I think, nearly 20 years ago or something like that, or 18 years. But we didn't work together to start with. It's like literally we stayed in contact and we thought we like each other. And down the road, when Adam was then heavily working for Patrick as his associate and co-designer, still running his own entity back in the day, there was the need for some visualization work at Patrick's end for a show in Brazil or something like that it was. And in those days, I did quite a bit of visualization work for myself, but also for other people. With WYSIWYG and then later on with ESP Vision and things like that. So it all started with Adam, who I've been in contact loosely over the years, putting me in touch with Patrick to do a bit of rendering and visualization work for him. And we did that, and that kind of worked out well. So we did more, or I did more visualization work for them. And ultimately, that led to the next step, ultimately to that they needed somebody as a lighting director or programmer for a very small show. And then we jumped into that water together and tried out that water together to work on a real show, not only putting renderings together. And it seemed that it worked out well as well. And also we figured out that from a personality standpoint, we ticked and it all grew from there. And that was literally, now the first show was about 15 years ago, 16 years, somewhere around about that region.
Very successful run.
And and literally from small shows, it evolved into bigger shows. And it evolved, first of all, to just take out shows for them who were somebody else programmed. And I got more on the programming side. moved on to do the design work for them, work as an associate, up to the point like projects for like whatever Rammstein or Genesis, which we co-designed. So literally me and Patrick co-designed. And I'm very thankful for both of them, Adam as well as Patrick, because they've been, first of all, super influential in my career. They opened up doors. And I mean, obviously, to put whatever Rolling Stones on your credit list and having worked with those guys opens doors to other projects internationally.
Yeah.
And opens up the door to the wider world. And aside of all that, foremost, I learned a lot from them. Well, I learned a lot about lighting as well as about...
Oh, I can't imagine. Yeah. How does that work, though, co-designing a show like the size of Rammstein with Patrick Woodruff? You know, who sends the first idea, and then how does that... Is it a collaboration? Is it, he just kind of gives you really high-level stuff, and then you send it back to him with all the details filled in, or how does it work?
It's different on every project, literally. Yeah. Sometimes... Rammstein possibly not so much, but on certain, some projects, he's got a big idea. He's got the high level idea, and you just kind of refine it and give it some life. On other shows, like whatever Rammstein, for instance, we all started on a, or even Genesis, we started on a clean white canvas. And the good thing is that we are both able to, I think, switch off our egos and just play that creative ping pong. And ultimately, and this is also the take on any project I do, which I've learned over the years, it doesn't matter who's got an idea, as long as the idea is beneficial to the show or to the project you're working on, that's key. And then if you can switch your ego off at that point of time in the wider group as well, with the set designer or production designer, with the production manager, with everybody, in the perfect world, with everybody, and sit around a table and just do some brainstorming and share ideas and play the ping pong. That is a great breeding ground for great ideas to grow and to really create some magic. And this is exactly, I mean, one of the cool things about the collaboration I had with Patrick over the years is like literally that when we co-designed stuff, it was always on that level. And it's like, literally, it was like playing ping pong. He had an idea. Great. Let's do it this way. I had an idea. All right. Let's put it in that way. And
can you ever say no to one of Patrick Woodruff's ideas?
Honestly, I'm an honest person. So we are all humans. And even though Patrick Woodruff sometimes possibly, at least in my eyes at that point of time, has got an idea which is not the greatest, I think, or is possibly a wrong way to go, then it's like just it's an open discussion board without any egos, so there's nothing wrong about saying no to something or at least share your opinion about it, and vice versa. If you're at that level to share ideas the way that you also can criticize or be criticized, and it's perfect. Because
it's just so interesting, though, because Patrick is such a legend. You know, Patrick has done this at such a high level for such a long time. So I would think that I'd be sweating a little bit and maybe shaking and saying, but Patrick, do you think maybe this would be a better idea? And then like, oh, don't hit me, you know?
No. That's one of the cool things about my dear friend Patrick is like he's been without any doubt very successful over a very long period of time, possibly one of the most successful out there, at least over the years.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, he's a human being, and he's a great character. He's most of the times down to earth. So it's a great relationship, which I really feel humbled that we were able to create this good relationship. It doesn't start that way. It builds over the years into something like that.
Well, and probably you earned his trust and respect very early on, and then that carried you through there. Like, he knows when Roland brings an idea to the table, it's probably not a stupid idea. I'm going to listen to it and then maybe add my color to it or whatever. But, you know, you're going to be treated as an equal, not as a junior designer or something. But, What was I going to say? So if I look at a video of Genesis or a picture of Genesis, like, are there elements that you could point out and say, that was my idea, that was Patrick's idea, that was my idea, or did it all just blend together?
As well as, I would say, it's both moments in the show. It's like quite a few things where it all blends together.
Yeah.
And there are moments which is, or even possibly sometimes songs or parts of the show where it's like actually that was done by myself, and there's parts of this where actually that is Patrick's thing. And,
yeah.
But again, ultimately down the road, it doesn't matter, because as long as you achieve a great result or a better result by sharing thoughts and sharing creative ideas, it can only be better, I think, for both ends ultimately.
Yeah, that's really cool. So, you know, what, like, maybe from earlier on, maybe from recently, but what's like some of the big things, or one of the big things that you learned from working with, you know, Patrick Woodruff, with a legend? Like, what are a couple of the biggest things that you have taken away from that?
Possibly the biggest thing overall I've taken away from my long-term relationship and friendship with Patrick is how you really kind of sell yourself, how you behave, how you deal with clients or artists, how you talk to them, how you do all this communication work. Because, yeah. I mean, it's quite an interesting part on bigger shows, and the bigger shows are getting, the less you're really designing if you're in the role of a co-designer or lead designer.
Yeah.
Because you're more and more slipping into the role of this political interface between the end client, who could be one artist or it could be a group of people.
Yeah.
And basically the team which is really doing the work, which is programming it, or your associate designer who makes nitty-gritty work. And being that interface and being that person, what I've learned, that you always have got a good overview over the bigger picture. So it's not only that moment. It's never only about lighting. It's always the bigger picture, which includes all visual elements. And again, also that the most important part of any show is not our lighting or not our production design or nor our whatever special effects. It's the guy who's on deck or on the stage or the group or whatever it is. Those are, I think, a few things I really am really appreciate, or I really took away from working with somebody who's been successful over such a long time.
Yeah. No, that's amazing. I mean, what a, you know, again, what a killer opportunity, and you know, you bring so much to the table as well, but you know, it's just such a killer opportunity to pair up with somebody at the level of Patrick Woodruff. You know, he's like you said, arguably the biggest name, you know, for a very, very long career. And he has, sort of risen out of just the Stones, being the Stones designer, mm-hmm. you know, like, I think that was one of the things that Brickman maybe had a little trouble with, is getting away from being Pink Floyd's lighting designer and creating a new Mark Brickman when Pink Floyd disappeared. Where Patrick Woodruff has been very successful, you know, even into some architectural projects and things, he's been very successful. So, yeah, that's cool. You were like a really early pioneer in the use of servers, right?
I would say so. Yeah, if I was a pioneer, I don't know, but for sure, one of the first guys who played around with video, or the integration of video into the lighting world and merging those two worlds. I will guess somewhere late 90s, 98 to 99.
That's pretty early.
We started to play around with very, very rudimental VJ tools and triggered videos by MIDI keyboards, which we put next to our lighting board.
Yeah.
So this is how the whole idea started, because we wanted to have control over that, and then got involved with Richard Bleasdale in the UK, who then later on created Catalyst, and were possibly one of the very first users of Catalyst, or however it was called, Samsk or something like that, before it was called Catalyst, and I bought it. And to start to really control video from a lighting board and because again, I thought decently early in my career that it's whatever we create, it's not only about lighting, it's also the video part, it's the set part, it's all one thing. And nothing against videos, but they are very, at least back in the day, they were very much about their world. And wow, there were LED screens. Now you put the brightness up to 11, yeah, and you don't see any lighting anymore. So yeah, there was no real kind of really working together of those two visual elements. So I really liked the idea of getting more control of video. And
yeah,
I mean, nowadays it has progressed so much. And again, with what I've done over the last 5 to 10 years, it overtook me big time. But what we started back in the day has definitely paid dividends now, because there's so much amazing technology out there from different companies, whatever, yeah, Disguise and Hippo and however they're all called. And it has really formed an own industry within the industry,
yeah,
media server programmers, and now all the stuff they're also doing in this merge between servers and VR and AR. And
yeah,
crazy. It's crazy.
Yeah, no, it's going to be interesting to see where some of that technology goes, like where you have like multiple formats happening where people are wearing goggles at a concert or you know, just different things like that. Like I can see this getting just nuts over the next 10 years, 15 years, and consoles programming themselves. I was talking to somebody about that on a podcast recently, you know, with all the advancements in AI, it's not going to be very long before the designer just talks to the console and the console programs itself. You know, I'm sure it's coming soon, you know, probably within the next couple of years. So video, you know, what would your opinion, and I know you're interesting because you cross over, like you do video for the Stones, you're a lighting designer, more or less video? Like, do we need more or less video?
And again, it all comes down to what kind of show you want to create and what kind of artists you've got on the deck. There are shows, modern shows, whatever, any one of the younger pop artists, where there's every right in the world to create this very digital feel of using video as scenery and creating massive screens. Nevertheless, if you on the other end of the spectrum think about a proper rock band or metal band, whatever, Rammstein is a great example, because in Rammstein, thanks God, we work with a band who doesn't like video at all, which is, I think, a perfect fit, because that kind of music, that kind of stuff they're trying to produce is anything but digital. It's very analog. It's rock and roll straight in your face. So you want to have a big, massive architectural set, and you want to have really strong lighting. You want to have pyro effects. But what you don't want to have or achieve is a huge television screen, which,
yeah,
again, it wouldn't be the right tool.
Yeah.
It always comes down. And I mean, if I have a general take on design anyway, it's not technical to start with, because you design a show, or you design a basic look for a show, and you've got this image in your head, or possibly as a sketch on your sketchbook, or possibly as a render, doesn't matter, but you've got this certain look you want to achieve. And this look then dictates what kind of tools are needed. And it could be video, but it could be no video at all. So there's,
yeah,
again, it all comes down what the job needs.
Yeah.
And not just used to video, because video is cheaper nowadays, and you could afford whatever, a few hundred square meters of LED wall. And there's great, amazing video products out there, transparent screens with high resolutions in nowadays, and
yeah,
lightweight screens, and stuff which even kind of is flexible, and you can do lovely curves. But ultimately, that doesn't matter if it's video or lighting. In my opinion, never use technology for technology's sake. It's all about using technology for a reason. The reason is always to create the look you're striving for or you want to achieve.
Yeah, but so, you know, it's an interesting topic. And again, I hate to keep bringing up Mark Brickman's name, but we had this conversation where, you know, the younger pop bands, like you said, they love to have this visual element and lots of movement and colorful things on the screens and lots of screens. And maybe that fits really well. But when you get to a classic artist like the Stones, and, you know, so I happen to love the design with the like four big iPhone video screens, right? And but I was talking to Brickman about it, and Brickman said, I had a bit of a problem with it. And I said, why? And he said, because those video screens made Mick Jagger look small. And he had a very interesting point, because when you look at the stage, you see this tiny little Mick Jagger, and then you see these huge images of like stuff on the screens. And so, you know, he said, I would be fine with those screens if they were IMAG, but because they were sort of a combination of all kinds of things, it just tended to make Mick Jagger look small. So it was an interesting comment. I mean, not that his opinion means everything, you know, it's just an opinion, of course, but
he's not wrong. And if I look at, I mean, we toured No Filter, the design you're just talking about.
Yeah.
For, I think, for 17, 18, 19, and 21, or 4 years.
Wow.
Basically, we toured the same design. But obviously evolved over the years was, first of all, the video content a little bit, and also what we did with those walls. When we started in 17, it was mostly using them as big scenic elements, which ultimately translates. And I get Brickman's point there. It translates into making the musician on stage look small compared to this high towers of video. But down the road, we started possibly with having 50% content on and 50% IMAG, either IMAG only, or most of the time IMAG embedded into content, immersed into content.
Yeah, I saw some of that stuff.
Which is already, I think, the right way to go.
Oh, yeah.
But ultimately, that by the years this show and this design progressed, I think we got more and more IMAG back in. IMAG always used in a way that it didn't look like a big telly screen, because this is something I don't like at all, and thanks God Patrick doesn't like either, to have a huge telly screen and possibly normal 16:9 format.
Yeah,
that's wrong. And there are. Even if you have a screen which has got exactly those, the scale or this measurements, there are still easy ways to get out of this little loophole and to by putting whatever a little gradient around the whole IMAG you're using, tinting the IMAG, always make it feel more like a beautiful art piece which is in the background. Obviously, still being able to transport the important information, which is Keith Richards playing a solo or whatever is the important information.
Yeah, you know, like you said, it's different. It's always different. It depends on the artist. It depends on the situation. Obviously, you know, in a stadium, you're going to have different needs than in an arena or whatever. But I mean, you know, for an EDM artist, for example, you want the craziest images and all kinds of really crazy content and stuff, because everybody in the audience is stoned out of their brains on Molly, looking up at these screens going, whoa, you know, and the artist is a DJ. So, you know, it's not Mick Jagger, right? It's very different.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. No, that's a cool thought. Like video, it seems like we've gone through these trends with video when LED screens first came available, and I don't know if you remember, what was it, Element Labs, their stealth screen, when people started using that like crazy and just putting video on anything they could. And it just kind of really took over from lighting. And like you said, they kept getting higher in their nits and brighter. And now you had the screens getting brighter, so the lights had to get brighter. And it just became like this in your face, like, oh my God, it's bright. Yeah. Like you couldn't see the artist because there was just so many lights blasting you in the face all the time. And then it seems like we've gotten back to a point where it's a really nice blend right now. Like the shows that I'm seeing now, video is being executed in a much more, I wouldn't say subtle, it's not subtle at all, but it's just better blended with the lighting. It's not like competing with the lighting, and lighting's not trying to outdo the video. It just seems to be nicely put together now.
I fully agree, and I think that Yeah, for the most part.
Yeah.
No, but that's the way to go. I mean, this is as sad. Even though you're possibly only the lighting designer, you always should keep in the back of your head that you should keep the bigger picture in the back of your head, basically. The bigger
yeah.
picture is anything our eye sees, or if you're talking about a broadcast or a TV production, anything the camera sees. And sometimes I like to put on my audience or my punter glasses, which is literally because if I go to a show, obviously, we as coming from our industry, we go into a show and we look around. It's like, well, there's the newest moving light. There's this great thing. And he's using that. Why is he using that? But if you don't have our background, you go into a show to foremost see your artist, enjoy a lovely evening and be hopefully be immersed into the show by some lovely visuals.
Yeah.
But you don't take or you don't pay any attention on the kind of technology which is used and so on and so forth. So it's
yeah.
always about the whole thing. And they don't really differentiate between lighting or video. What they see is always kind of the sum of all different visual elements, which
yeah.
is lighting, which is video, which is your set production design, which is any special effects.
It's an experience. It's
anything. It's an experience.
Yeah, it's all part of an experience. They're all components. Elements.
Yep. Exactly. And those components need to work together
yeah.
to really create magic and just amazing moments or amazing looks on shows, or it has to work together and it has to work for whatever action is happening on stage.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't even limit that to any kind of rock and roll stuff or music stuff. It doesn't matter if there's a band on stage or if there's a theatrical piece happening on stage
yeah.
or if it's a musical or if it's even a boring corporate gig where they present a new Chevrolet something. Again, there it is all about the car. And it has to, we just create this visual picture frame around it. And all elements of the visual picture frame should work together in the best possible way to give the artist or whatever the action on stage is, the best possible canvas to really draw the detail in.
It's funny that you're in Germany, but you selected an American car for your example. A Chevrolet.
I like American cars and I like American motorsports. So
yeah.
possibly for that reason.
Yeah.
Even so, I'm driving a German one.
Yeah, me as well. Me as well. I'm a big fan of German cars. You know, it's just German cars to me. Like when you pull the door, it goes whoomp. It closes like with a boom, and it's solid, and there's no rattles after it closes. You know, with a Ford or a GM or something, you close the door and it rattles for 5 minutes after. You know, they're just not built quite as solid, I guess.
Yeah.
So Rammstein, which you've corrected me on, I was calling them Rammstein, which I guess is wrong, but
Rammstein.
Rammstein. Yeah. So that came to you through Patrick, correct?
Yes and no. I mean, it was basically the initial contact was from my end, and back in the day, I had 4 years, somewhere 4 or 5 years, where I channeled all my own business through Woodruff Bassett Design, Patrick's and Adams company as well, where we kind of collaborated 100%, which was ended by COVID, ultimately. But that's a different story. And I think the very initial contact was my dear old friend, Nikolai Sobotka, who's Rammstein's production manager.
Okay.
And we chatted about Rammstein, and we chatted about that they are possibly heading out again, and that they could possibly they were interested in possibly changing their design team to just do something different, because not for any bad reason, because I think what Roy did for them, Leroy Bennett did for them for somewhat 10 or 15 years he spent with them is outstanding, and I think Roy was influential in the visual appearance of that band big time, so there was no bad blood or no reason to move on just because they were not happy. They just wanted to have something different and got a different option. And so this was the really kind of the starting point of the conversation we had. And then obviously, as I was with Patrick at full time, kind of permalance, and you call it in new words, that obviously went through the WBD radar. And basically, it went from there. And then obviously, Patrick got involved as well, because we formed a tech team. It was Patrick and myself to start with, but from the get-go, it was kind of very, very obvious that this production will only be a success if we also got a sparring partner in terms of production design. Because so I contacted my friend Florian Vida, who, funny enough, is from the same city. Basically, he grew up in Munich, and kind of a Munich homie as well. But he's always been over in the broadcast industry. He's been big. I mean, in the broadcast world, he's possibly, at the moment at least, the most successful or most sought after production designer worldwide. Doesn't matter if in Europe or in the States. Nevertheless, rock and roll was a little new for him, but we brought him on board, and he brought so much to that project. I mean, ultimately, the great thing was, again, that the three of us, Patrick, myself, as well as Florian, we switched off all our egos and played the ping pong together to create what ultimately was then decided by the band to take out.
What about all the scenic design?
All Florian, or it's the nitty and gritty, the detail work is Florian and Kuno. Kuno is his main kind of in-house art director slash co-designer, super, super talented man from Munich as well. And there was ultimately the three of us created the bigger picture, high level idea of where it should go. So we had the idea of building a tower, a very dystopian tower.
Yeah.
But all the scenic kind of tweaks and really detail work then was done by Florian and Kuno.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that tower, you're talking about the monster structure in the center of the stage, right?
Yep.
Yeah. That thing's outrageous. Like that's that. And then I don't know if it's like sound delay towers or something where you've got the pyro coming out of the top of those.
Mm-hmm.
That show just blows my mind. Like, you know, and I've never seen it live. I've only seen it on video, but it blows my mind. I mean, the pyro is outrageous. The lighting is outrageous. The scenic designs are outrageous. The costumes are outrageous. Just as a visual thing, it's just like mind blowing, you know? And I have no idea what the hell the band is saying, you know, like what does Du hast mean anyways?
Direct translation would be "you've got me."
Oh, okay,
much.
Okay.
Yeah. But it's ultimately that band is a proper playground for any creative in this industry, because there you've got every right in the world to go to town in terms of and visual extravaganza, and you really can take it to an extreme, and for a good reason, because they've what they created over the years has been a very visual language. And I think at least at some parts of the career, it was kind of fundamental to their success to do those crazy live shows. And I mean, even on a smaller scale, they did crazy things.
I mean, I guess there's boundaries that you have to stay within. Like you couldn't have a white set. You couldn't have pink lights, you know. It has to be it's an industrial metal band, right? Like it's gotta have that industrial look. And
they got their band corporate identity, if you want to call it that way, and within this band corporate identity, which they created mostly by themselves, helped a lot by Roy, actually, I think. This gives you definitely a direction, and you can't break out completely. But you can put your own twist on it, and you can take it to, let's say, to another level. But you can and really progress on it. And I think that is what we've achieved very, very, very well together within the team of myself, Patrick, and Florian, but also the band by themselves, because they're very involved in the whole process.
Oh, really? They get involved in the design aspect of it and... the creative
100%.
Aspect. Oh, that's cool. Who? 100%. Which member of the band?
It's mostly Paul on the lighting side. One of their guitarists. He's super interested, but all of them have got an opinion, and that's good. But an opinion in a very good way. So, and I mean, they've grown from literally playing in front of whatever 10 people in their very early stages of their career to what they are now, by far the most successful German act over the years. But they've always been very involved into especially pyrotechnics by themselves, or especially like, but
Who does
also
their pyro? Because it's pretty incredible.
it's amazing.
Yeah.
It's funny enough, it's the company of the production manager, because he founded in down times. He's been Nikolai Sabotka has been with Rammstein, I think, since the mid 90s or somewhere like that, so also early stages. And at some point they hit some limits in terms of what is achievable in terms of special effects. And he had the thought that he could do it better, and he could, because for some special effects, I think he's one of the best guys out there. So he founded his own company. I think originally they only worked with Rammstein, but obviously down the road they ventured out as well, and it's called FFP. It's Berlin and Los Angeles based, and
Oh,
they're
wow.
doing quite a bit of work. I mean, Roy got them involved, I think, in quite a few of his shows. So they just recently last year,
Yeah.
they also did Lady Gaga. They did work for Kiss,
Oh.
some cool stuff. And
I mean,
especially,
it's killer. It's just like completely outrageous. I love it. So that show, like so first of all, when did Rammstein get this big? Like, when did they go from playing in regular arenas like every other German act or whatever to being this massive stadium sensation? When did that happen?
it's a process which happened over the years. I
Yeah.
mean, I think the band was founded, don't nail me down on that, in the very early 90s, literally. I mean, they
Yeah.
all played together in different constellations in the 80s, in the eastern part of Germany before the wall came down.
Yeah.
So this is where it all origins, and it's all this from this very small rock and roll punk rock scene from the East Germany back in the days. They started and they got successful, I would say, at least on a national level in the early mid 90s. And from there on, continued. By the late 90s, they were already doing arenas and big festival headline slots in Europe. And then it's a longer story, but for everybody who's listened, it's very worthwhile watching. There's this documentary, a really good film, documentary film called Rammstein America. And that is a 2-hour film about how they broke into the American market, which is obviously a difficult market to break into. And especially considering that
You don't speak any
were
English in any of your
saying
songs.
they got, I think, one song which is kind of English, but everything else is German.
Yeah.
And it's interesting how they took on it, because when they've already been very, very successful in Europe and in Russia and in our end of the world, they wanted to break America. And they got over there and they played in a club in New York in front of 20 people or 30 people. They sort of started off from scratch to a certain degree
Wow.
again. But they had so much commitment, and obviously the act by itself works, because it's really kind of it's cool. It's really groovy music. It works. It is basically it's making fun of German stereotypes all the way through, marching and
Yeah.
speaking that way as nobody speaks in Germany, never.
Yeah.
And that all combined with their very theatrical approach of doing live shows has got every right in the world to kind of be successful anywhere in the world.
Well,
But if
do they do stadiums everywhere though, or just in Europe?
no, they're now, I mean, when we started to work with them, and I mean, we're still are the new kids on the block with them, because we just designed this tour, which is still out for them. That
Yeah.
was their very first own stadium production.
Oh, okay.
Beforehand, they played the biggest festivals in the world, all around the world. They played in front of whatever, 100,000 people or 200,000 people
Yeah.
in Russia. They played all the big shows, whatever. At least the big metal shows, let's put it that way,
Yeah.
and the festivals. But from the point of view of touring, or own touring productions, their limit was arenas. Basically, they did arenas and festivals.
Yeah.
So it was it, for them. It was a step up in terms of venue size and to really put together an own stadium production.
Yeah.
19 was their first year of touring stadiums, and I mean, proof of concept was that literally that first tour sold out in a heartbeat, and still now they're on their third year running Europe with this show.
Wow.
Going, I think, to most places they're going this year. They've been to, and even it's the third year there. They sell a show out in
that's unbelievable.
Less than a day.
And, so, and, do you have two rigs like leapfrogging each other, or is there days between shows, or how does it work?
It isn't. Let's put it that way. It isn't a light take on stadium touring, but a very healthy way, and I think something most productions in our day and age do. They got two steel sets, so two full steel sets, so they're leapfrogging, so that you can do whatever three shows a week or something like that.
Yeah.
They got a little bit of advanced production, mostly cables, a few lights, but very minimal, very minimal. And then it's one big Universal production where they carry the lighting rig, all the special effects, PA system, most of the set or the cladding of the steel structure is also on a Universal. And so with this one and a half shows, which they're touring, they can still do three shows a week, which is, I think, a fair line.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Yeah.
They're doing no stupid stuff like whatever, touring stadiums on that scale back to back, which others have done and have done successfully, but that obviously then requires a lot more money to be spent, and possibly that the lot more money you spend doesn't make it worthwhile with the added income.
Yeah. So, I mean, last question on Rammstein, just because I'm interested, but does it make you like a national hero or whatever now that you're working with the band that, you know, is the pinnacle of success in Germany? Yeah.
I wouldn't say so. As I say, I see myself never as a hero. I'm just.
But it's probably the most important lighting design job in Germany.
In Germany,
right?
In terms of touring, for sure. And,
yeah.
It was.
It's the Paul McCartney of Germany or Rolling Stones.
Absolutely. And it has been within a long time. I've been there been together with Patrick. I've been the first German designer.
Because
I think for the last 15 odd years, before 19, early 2000s, late 90s, I would have got to look it up. They worked with Leroy and very successfully. And Leroy did amazing work for them. So, so it must have been somewhere in the late 90s that the whole show was designed by a German the last time.
Yeah. Wow. That's incredible.
It obviously makes you feel a little proud, to be honest.
Yeah. And, yeah. Oh, it has to. You know, I'm Canadian, so I guess it'd be similar to, I don't know, Rush or something in Canada, but not even close, because Canada doesn't have any big stadium stuff like that, right? But that's really, really super interesting. I want to see that show live at some point. I'd love to see it in Europe, you know, not here in the US, in Europe, where it's like a cultural phenomenon, sort of, you know. It's like, yeah, that'd be pretty fun. So speaking of like German bands and stuff, do you know a metal band called Destruction?
I heard about them. Yeah. And I think in my youth, I've listened to a bit of metal, and I think I had one album of them. I don't really remember
it's,
much more.
I mean, they do all the festivals, all the, you know, you guys are so big on these metal festivals. Like when metal was totally dead in the rest of the world, Germany, it was still alive and well.
Yep.
Yeah, and these, so anyways, one of my good friends from Canada that I kind of grew up with is the drummer in that band, In Destruction. He lives in Berlin,
cool.
And I think he's married now to a German girl. And
nice.
So he's been with Destruction for, I don't know, 10 years or something.
Very small world.
Yeah. So I like to end each episode with just basically your go-to gear. So, you know, the gear that you have to have on every show, like call it five things, five pieces of equipment that you won't do a show without or can't do a show without.
Right. Depends on the show. I mean, if you talk about a concert, I would say any show needs moles in any shape or form. And nowadays, thanks God, now we've got some LED substitutes which work. So moles I would put in there. You need some kinds of instruments, doesn't matter if they're automated or not, to do a proper key lighting for your band. And beside of that, a comfy chair to sit in front of house.
You're not the first person who has said that.
I would guess so. I learned one thing from Patrick, which I try to do also on my own projects, is to get a comfy couch on top of that, at least for programming, not for touring a show, but for programming. And it's for own your own comfort, but it's also psychologically a great asset if you're talking to your client and he or she comes out to front of house and you can put in a couch. So couch, that's about and a good team around you.
Probably a console,
Yeah,
MMA
a
console.
console up there. Yeah. And console. Let's put it at the console of the choice of your programmer. And if you're programming, if I would be programming myself, an MA.
That's interesting. Cool. Did I miss anything? I don't know. Like
Sure.
I tried to go through your career when I was preparing for this, and you've done so many things. I mean, obviously Adele is another one, but and there's an artist, I think it's a French artist or something, that's huge. I mean, maybe it's a German, a woman.
Oh, well, Helene Fischer is a German artist. Yeah, we've done a
That
few bits and pieces for her.
also quite a big show.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was blessed to do some interesting stuff. And in our day and age, it's not about the size anymore because, as we all had, or everybody has, I had a phase in my life where it was all about size matters and bigger shows. But by now, it's more about the quality of the show. And it all comes down to the quality of the people you're working with. On one side, within your team or within the team of creatives or production, but also on the client side or on the other end of the cable, so the artist. And if you work with the right people, it doesn't matter. It could be a very, very small show, as long as you achieve something which is special or this is magic. If you can achieve that, and that the best breeding ground is working with cool people, this is what I'm striving for.
Yeah,
And it doesn't matter.
that's when you've won life, I guess, is when you really enjoy the people that you're working with, and
Yeah.
everyone respects each other. So if you had to choose one of your shows, if you were to get hit by a bus tomorrow, God forbid, and one show had to be the one that you're remembered for, what would it be?
Possibly the Last Genesis.
It's a beautiful show. It's an
Yeah,
unbelievable
there's
show. We
like,
talked about it before we started recording, but it was sad to see Phil Collins, unable to perform like he would have liked to, obviously. But visually, what a beautiful show.
thank you. And it was also it was a big challenge. I mean, Patrick has worked with them at least twice before, but I was a new kid in this camp. I worked with the Phil Collins group for a few years. But obviously doing Genesis, which is a heavily influential band within our part of the industry,
Yes,
so in
very
terms of
much.
lighting, and they've always pushed the boundaries. They've always been groundbreaking for a lot of things. Doesn't matter if you think about back in the early 80s with Very Lights, later on with possibly the first band who toured bigger video screens, and so on and so forth. That was some big shoes to fill to a certain degree, and a big challenge, especially nowadays, because in nowadays it's a little more difficult to create something groundbreaking because there's a lot of technology out there. There's now every little club in Munich uses moving lights, so nothing special. To fill those shoes, and I think within the team we worked together on that with Patrick and Jeremy Lloyd from Wonderworks, who did the technical design. Also the production and the band by itself. We achieved it in a really cool way to be progressive and also take Genesis into the 21st century to put a bridge in between their heritage and their long-standing careers. But also you had Nick Collins, Phil's son, playing the drums, actually, and so you've got basically a 20-year-old kid on stage playing drums, super talented. But there's just two generations on deck, and it was cool, and it was emotional. It's like
that's the end
possibly
of the...
at some point it was possibly at some point that we'll have the same moment with the Stones or any other of these
course,
old school bands.
Stones can't tour forever, although they've been trying to.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah,
but with Genesis last, it's pretty much 1 year ago, end of March 2022, we did this last run of three shows at the O2 Arena, and when the last night hit, it was like, even in the night, it was still, it felt a little different, but the next morning when you realized you just have done the last show of one of the last remaining big giants in the pop/rock music world.
Yeah.
It was like, wow.
Yeah. No, it's, and unfortunately, you know, you're a bit younger than me, but at my age, like a lot of my heroes are starting to die now, you know, my musical heroes are starting to die and retire for sure. It's sad, you know, it's sad. It's every time someone dies, you're like, oh wow, I remember the first time I heard that song or whatever. Right. And so going out and touring with those, I can imagine it would be very emotional.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you doing this very much, Roland. I've enjoyed learning a bit about your career and certainly a lot more about some of these bands and stuff. Thank you so much for doing it.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me. It was good to chat with you, and thanks for recording all those things for generations to come, hopefully, who could listen to that in whatever 10 years' time.
Absolutely. That's the whole idea is just storing these things in a vault, you know, everyone's stories and stuff, because we're not going to be around forever. And, absolutely. You know, let's face it, the young kids need our help these days.
100%.
Yeah.
100%.
They need to be guided a bit. Well, thank you so much, and safe travels, and enjoy a few days off here.
Thank you.
All right,
Russell. Have a good one. Take care.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bother a girl like you. You get your cake and you eat.